Okay, so tonight we continue 2,000 years of the Jewish Odyssey, a look at the 16th century, sponsored again by Becky Navi Katz, Le'ilu Nishmas Yonah, Ben Rav Aryeh Leib, Tehi Nishmas Tzur V'Tzar Chaim. The 16th century began with the Jewish people reeling from the cataclysm of the 15th century, the expulsion from Spain. The shockwaves that would set off would reverberate throughout the 16th century, which was a remarkable century in which so many trends and personalities shape us until today. It's very difficult to contain it to 1 hour or less, but I will try. In fact, as we get closer to modern times, the historical record itself grows to such an extent that it's necessary to pare down and relate only the most crucial of the elements of those centuries. But the 16th century does stand out for its enduring facets. Within 3 months of the expulsion in 1492, the Spanish economy was already in decline. So Ferdinand and Isabella invited back all Jews who had left to reclaim their property, the only condition being they convert to Christianity. Their primary targets, in fact, were Jews who had taken refuge in Portugal, and there were very few takers. More than 100,000 Jews had fled to Portugal after August 1492, where they were greeted in 1493 with a devastating plague. And then it got worse. While some Jews fled back to Spain and became conversos, most weathered the storm until 1496, when King Manuel of Portugal issued his own decree of expulsion. So it was 1492 all over again, a little worse this time, the difference being that here the church kidnapped and forcibly baptized thousands of Jewish children, imprisoning or expelling their parents. So Jews in the tens of thousands became conversos with all the problems that entailed. So at first, when he issued the expulsion decree, very few Jews were allowed to leave Portugal, but after vicious pogroms in 1504 and 1506, Manuel himself allowed the Jews to leave, which they did, including conversos, by the thousands, traveling east to other more relatively stable Jewish communities, and at the end of the 16th century, north to the Netherlands, where the Spanish-Portuguese Jews would become very prominent in the 17th century. Of the conversos who stayed, they were subjected to a Portuguese Inquisition in the 1520s, led by another apostate Jew named Enrico Nunez, a native of the Canary Islands. He sang like a canary too, so he knew exactly how to ferret out conversos, and he duly filed the report exposing them to the king. Unlike in Spain, where there was the pretext of a trial, these conversos were then often just summarily executed. The desperation now in the Jewish world had several ramifications. For some of them, the first, but not the last time we would encounter them. Among the first manifestations, the rise of false messiahs. These gentlemen were always mysterious, always enigmas. The first to appear was a Jew named David HaRuveni. David of Reuven, 1490 to 1535, a short, swarthy Arabian, not that we have anything against short, swarthy Arabians, but he claimed to be from the tribe of Reuven, hence the name, who had escaped from the other side of the river Sambatyon, and he presented himself as the ambassador of the 10 lost tribes to the other Jews in the world, as well as to the non-Jewish world. So he appeared first in Egypt, then Yerushalayim, then he went to Rome, where Pope Clement VII authorized him to solicit support from the other kings of Europe for an invasion of the land of Israel. He then traveled to Portugal, where conversos greeted him as a liberator, thereby exposing themselves. But even the king of Portugal granted him ambassadorial status. Very charismatic figure, as false messiahs always are. Now the Rabbanim almost entirely opposed him. They saw him as a charlatan, but the Jewish people across the world were swept away by him. He, like many false messiahs, overstayed his welcome, like a lot of people, not false messiahs. He infuriated the church by openly teaching Torah to conversos in Portugal, even converted a Muslim girl to Judaism. But in the middle of his activity, he joined forces with another converso named Diego Perez, an immensely talented scholar, became a great Talmud Chacham, who was raised as a converso, barely knowing he was Jewish, then returned to Judaism, circumcised himself, and called himself Shlomo Molcho, 1500 to 1532. Shlomo Molcho became Rav Shlomo Molcho, traveled to Turkey, where he learned with the Maritach of Yosef Taitatzak, one of the great Gedolim of Turkey, and Rabbi Yosef Karo, who was living there. We'll get back to him later. He then went to Israel. Shlomo Molcho then went to Italy, where Clement VII, the Pope, greeted him warmly as well. And he had a certain talent for prognostication that buttressed his proclaimed identity. He predicted that there'd be a devastating flood in Rome in 1530. The Tiber River would overflow. Indeed, it happened. He predicted there'd be an earthquake in Portugal in 1531. He was accurate as well. He was imprisoned, though, in Rome when it was learned he was a converso from Portugal, but Pope Clement VII freed him. He left, but ultimately Charles V, who was the Holy Roman Emperor, turned him over to the Inquisition in Mantua, where, refusing to recant his return to Judaism, he was burned at the stake. That ended his career at the young age of 32. But many Gedolim felt very close to him. Rabbi Yosef Karo, in fact, spoke very highly, very warmly of Rav Shlomo Molcho, who is held to be one who died on Kiddush Hashem. He had messianic ambitions, but he was never overt about them. Meanwhile, David Hur-Uveni, who was overt about his claims, he was also arrested, and he simply disappeared. Most assume he died in prison, ending this episode of messianic flirtation with all the accompanying despair and recriminations that they've always brought us. Now, the Spanish exiles shaped Jewish life for centuries, and really until today. A plurality of the exiles turned first to Italy and Greece and Turkey for resettlement. They reestablished their culture and traditions there, not without some communal strife. I already noted last week that the Jewish community in Italy was not as welcoming of the Jews who fled Spain as they might have been. They felt they would take away jobs and encroach too much on the resources of the community. They continued as well, the exiles did, on Eretz Yisrael, especially in light of the new developments there, and the most welcoming home that the Jews of Spain found was actually in Turkey. The Ottoman Empire entered its heyday in the mid-15th century. It was a very brief period of time, maybe century, century and a half, where there were dominant forces, with the final expulsion of the Christians from Constantinople in 1453. Soon after, Jews were invited to live in Turkey and a community flourished. Moshe Kapsali, 1410 to 1500, was the chief rabbi. It was an appointed position by the Sultan, chief rabbi of Turkey, for close to 50 years. And he was the one, elderly, in his 80s already, who persuaded the Sultan to accept the fleeing Jews of Spain, and they did. He, Rabbi Moshe Kapsali, was succeeded in 1500 by the great Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi, 1450 to 1525. Tremendous Talmud Chacham. He was the Gadol Hador at this time throughout the world. He was also appointed chief rabbi of Turkey, author of numerous Shilas and Tshuvas, as well as a super commentary on Rashi's Perish on Chumash. The Ottoman Empire proved to be very hospitable, and for a time Torah flourished there. One Spanish exile, Rabbi Yaakov ibn Chaviv, was the mainstay, Rav of Salonika. Salonika was a Turkish town. It only became Greek in the 1920s, and of course was a scene of a major civil war, a major war between Greece and Turkey. Salonika then grew into a major Jewish community. that lasted until the Holocaust. Rabbi Yaakov Ibn Habib died in 1516, but not before beginning what would become one of the most popular works in Jewish literature, the Ein Yaakov, a compilation of all the Agados in Shas with his eponymous commentary, the Ein Yaakov. This work was completed, Ein Yaakov was completed by his son, Rabbi Levi Ibn Habib, 1485 to 1545, who soon left Salonika, went to Israel, and was appointed the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim. Later on in the century, in the 1570s, Rav Avram D. Boton, who was a Talmud of the Marashdam, Rav Shmuel D. Modina, both great Rabbonim in Salonika, Rav Avram D. Boton wrote the famous commentary Lechem Mishnah on the Rambam. So he had on the Mishnah Torah. So he had tremendous Talmidei Chachamim in Turkey in the 16th century. And one other fascinating figure, a Spanish exile named Shlomo Ibn Verga, ended up in Turkey as well after traveling through much of the world. He wrote in 1506 a historical book called Shevet Yehudah, an account of 64 persecutions, major persecutions by his count, that Jews had experienced since the Churban. The fact that he could compile this meant that there was a national consciousness arising amongst the Jewish people. He in fact decried Jewish passivity, that we just accept the persecution, don't fight back. But that national consciousness that was awakening had other consequences as well in the land of Israel. Israel experienced a rebirth in the 16th century after being dormant, maybe since the time of Ramban, if not even earlier than that. In no small part due to the expulsion from Spain, as well as the friendliness of the Ottomans. The land of Israel was conquered in 1516 by the Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent, his choice of description, not mine, but in fact he was magnificent. Suleiman was renowned for his compassionate and fair treatment of his Jewish subjects, renowned even more today for his construction of the walls that surround the old city of Yerushalayim, built in 1538, 2.8 miles in circumference, each of the walls about 10 feet thick. Suleiman was a patron of the arts. He visited the Topkapi Palace in Istanbul. You see his whole collection. He loved art and sculpture and precious objects. He was a legislator par excellence, one of the names by which the Turks referred to him as the great lawgiver. He was revered by his subjects for a number of reasons, including the fact that he was a progressive figure. He was a Muslim leader in stark contrast to the brutes and thugs that rule the Muslim world today. Now keep in mind that Jews had always lived in the land of Israel. The Ramban resettled Yerushalayim in 1267, but Israel had a revival in the 16th century that influences us until today. By the early 16th century, Sardim were a majority. Cities like Yerushalayim, Hebron, especially Tzfat, became major centers, with even a fierce rivalry between the Rabbonim of Yerushalayim and the Rabbonim of Tzfat. Hebron had its own sorrows, I think, in 1516, 1517. There had been a pogrom there during the upheaval of the conquest. So Yerushalayim and Tzfat became the major cities with all their feuds. Yerushalayim had been enriched by the arrival in 1488 of a great Italian Rav, Rav Ovadia Bartanura. Bartanura, a town in northern Italy, was a prime disciple of the Ma'arik. Rav Ovadia not only strengthened the community materially, but it was in Yerushalayim that he wrote his masterwork, his commentary on the Mishnah, that assumed the role similar to that of Rashi on the Talmud, and is simply known as Perush HaRav, the Rav's commentary on the Talmud. The Bartanura also established a major yeshiva in Yerushalayim that continued even after his death in 1516. Another yeshiva opened in Tzfat earlier in 1504, and thereafter, they had these two yeshivas in competition. The community struggled in their relationships. There, they were on opposite sides of a number of very important disputes. some of which sound very familiar to us today. For example, in 1504, they warred over when the Shemitah year would fall. The Rabbanim in Tzfat insisted that year, 5264, 1504, 1503, 1504, was a Shemitah year. Rabbanim Yerushalayim disagreed. You see from here, it's clear that because there have been so few Jews in Eretz Yisrael for centuries, they'd lost track of when the Shemitah year came. Ultimately, the Rabbanei Tzfat prevailed. We follow their calculation until today in the compilation of the Shemitah year, in 72 Shemitah since then. And thereafter, people turned to Tzfat for guidance rather than to Yerushalayim. And so great leaders flocked to Tzfat. Rabbi Yaakov Beirav, another Spanish exile, 1475 to 1546, at the tender age of 18, meaning the year after the expulsion, he became the Rav in Fez, Morocco. Then he made his way east, Algeria, Cairo, Yerushalayim, finally settling in and opening Yeshiva in Tzfat in 1524. Rav Yaakov Beirav was a protagonist in another great debate of the 16th century that also has modern implications, the fight over the reinstitution of Smicho. You'll recall, just a scant of 14 lectures ago, that 12 lectures ago, that Smicha, the Smicha for Moshe Rabbeinu, had lapsed in the 4th century with the final closure of the Sanhedrin. But based on interpretation of the Rambam in Hilchos Sanhedrin, Perek Dalad, Halacha Yud Aleph, Rabbi Yaakov Beirav deduced that if all the Talmidei Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael decided to convey Smicha to one person, that would start the chain of Smicha again for Moshe Rabbeinu, and he in turn could be Somech or Masmech others. Now his intentions were very noble. He held that in order to enable the conversos to gain complete atonement for their sins, and even pretending to convert, they needed Malkos from an authorized Sanhedrin. So that was his intention. The Sanhedrin should be reestablished. We give Malkos to those who want it. Usually those who don't want it deserve it, but give Malkos to those conversos who wanted a full tshuva, and then they would be able to reconstitute some semblance of Jewish life. Indeed, the Talmidei Chachamim in Tzfat duly ordained Rabbi Yaakov Beirav in 1538, and he in turn ordained four of them, including one of his prime disciples or followers, Rabbi Yosef Karo. But Rabbi Yaakov Beirav was vehemently opposed by the aforementioned Reb Levi Ibn Chaviv, who completed his father's Ein Yaakov, become a Rav in Yerushalayim. Rav Levi Ibn Chaviv disagreed with the concept and disagreed with the application, and said, besides that, when the Rambam spoke of unanimity, that meant the consent of all the rabbis in Yerushalayim too, not just the Rabbanim in Tzfat. So he disagreed, and the whole process he declared invalid, a farce. With this opposition, that new smicha lapsed after perhaps two more generations, but again a revival has been attempted in our day. We live in exciting times. In the last 5 years, a group of Talmidei Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael ordained Rav Adin Steinsaltz, reinstituted what they call the Sanhedrin, with mixed acceptance and none from the chief rabbinate. But that was a major conflagration that lasted a few decades. Rav Yosef Karo, perhaps the dominant figure in a century of dominant figures, left Toledo as a child refugee, born in 1488. He was four when he fled with his parents. He grew up, was raised, and learned in Turkey before coming to Israel in 1535. He was a stupendous, incomparable Talmud Chacham who immediately joined Rav Yaakov Beirav's Beis Din in Tzfat. He became Av Beis Din in 1546, and his Beis Din, Rabbi Yosef Karo, became the address for questions from across the world. He was a prolific writer in every sense of the word, and again, in a century of prolific writers, he began his first major work, in fact, what he considered his most important work, while still in Turkey. It took him 20 years. He completed it in Eretz Yisrael, and he called it the Beis Yosef, a commentary on the Tur, which is just a comprehensive analysis of every statement of the Tur with a variety of opinions and sources. It's indispensable to any person who studies Torah. What he did then was, just to make it convenient for people, he synopsized that work, the Beis Yosef, into what then became his magnum opus, the most famous work of this and many centuries, the Shulchan Aruch, literally a set table of the laws of the Jewish people, encompassing every area of life, except those that had no immediate relevancy. They applied to the era of the Mikdash. He used a very simple system to decide the halacha when there were disagreements in the Rishonim. He followed the majority of what he held to be the three main poskim in the Rishonim, the Rif, the Rambam, and the Rosh. It was all three? It was all three. If it was not all three, then he chose the majority, usually, almost every time, of the two out of the three. What's fascinating is that the Shulchan Aruch was meant to be a concise, handy guide to Jewish practice, if not a little paperback, but a single book that a person could carry with him, that he'd be able to know what to do in almost every situation in life. It was published first in Venice, in portions, tour by tour, over the 1550s. It's finally finished all together in 1563. Like any revolutionary work, it attracted opposition from those who felt, for example, that he did not take into account as much as he could have Ashkenazic practice. Opposition from those who thought, and this is a complaint you always hear, even today, it would spell the death knell of Talmud Torah, that no one would ever pick up a Gemara again. Why should they? They could learn the halacha from the Shulchan Aruch, and they would decide, people would start deciding halacha without any real knowledge of the Talmud, just by referencing the Shulchan Aruch. It's a complaint that you hear ad hayom with each new innovation in Jewish life. But when the Ramah, Rav Moshe Isserles of Poland, inserted his mapa, his tablecloth, so to speak, to the Shulchan Aruch, to the set table, in the Krakow edition of 1571, thereby rendering acceptable for Ashkenazim the place in Jewish life of the Shulchan Aruch, was forever cemented. Why? Part of it is organization, part of it is erudition, and part of it is mazel, for sure. But the Shulchan Aruch took its place alongside the Mishnah and the Gemara as works that define the era and that have eternal value. What's the proof? The proof is, within a century, it became the final word in halacha, but no longer a handy guide. The same phenomenon you found with the Mishnah and Gemara, numerous commentaries you found with the Shulchan Aruch as well. Within a century, dozens of commentaries would be written on the Shulchan Aruch, beginning already in the 16th century, soon after its publication, making it what it is today, not a small single volume, but a hefty 10-volume set. As if that wasn't enough, Rabbi Yosef Karo published as well towards the end of his life a massive commentary on the Rambam's Mishnah Torah, known as the Kesef Mishnah. The fact is, any of these three works, the Shulchan Aruch, the Beis Yosef, the Kesef Mishnah, would have sufficed for a legendary career. The fact that he wrote all three, and many other svarim as well, is remarkable, and so he's usually referred to just as the Mechaber, the author, or the Beis Yosef. Attributed to him, by the way, is a book of Shas and Shuvas called Avkas Rochel, in which he answers many questions that came his way, including some that plug us into the milieu. One of the questions that he dealt with was a phenomenon that arose in large measure in the 16th century because of the relative tranquility of the land of Israel, as well as the, it's hard to speak in these terms, but the dearth of major persecutions in the rest of the world. Jews used to come to Israel for Yom Tov. And so the question arose, should they hold one day, should they hold 2 days? The Jews coming from Chutz Lartz to celebrate Yom Tov in Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Yosef Karo answers in Simon Chavov of Avkas Rochel, he says, Maisim v'chol yom v'chol shana v'shana. It happens every Yom Tov now. Jews come from the exile, and he says they all hold 2 days. Even in Tzfat, there's a place, they have their own shul, make their own minyan, read the Torah the second day of Yom Tov. That's what it is. So said Rabbi Yosef Karo. Another dimension in Tzfat in the 16th century that has implications until today, it became renowned as the center of Kabbalah, of Jewish mysticism, a place that it retains until today. Rabbi Yosef Karo was a student of Kabbalah, but he was preceded by Shlomo Halevi Alkabetz, best known to us for his Lecha Dodi in Kabbalah Shabbos, but to others as the teacher in Kabbalah of his brother-in-law, the Ramak, or Moshe Cordovero, who became the leading Kabbalist of the age, very briefly, one of the teachers of Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, the Arizal, Ari standing for either Ashkenazi Rabbi Yitzchak or Eloki, the divine Rabbi Yitzchak, but known to everyone as the Arizal, Zichron Levracha. Sometimes I get the feeling he was called the Arizal even while he was alive, Arizal. Luria, of course, meant that he was a descendant, a native of Lorraine in France. He's Ashkenazi. In fact, his grandfather had come from Lorraine. The Ari was born in Yerushalayim, but he was raised in Cairo, very studied under the Radvaz of David ben Zimra, 1480 to 1573. A lot of the Sephardic Rabbonim were blessed with longevity that the Ashkenazim were not. He means he died at 93, the Radvaz. He became the chief rabbi of Egypt for 40 years before also moving to Jerusalem to Tzfat, another copious writer. The Ari was also a Talmud of Betzalel Ashkenazi in Cairo, Egypt. The Ari's influence is in inverse proportion to the length of his life, 1534 to 1572, only 38 years old when he died in an epidemic in Tzfat, and he only lived in Tzfat for 2 years, the last 2 years of his life. He left Egypt in 1570, went to Tzfat. Hard to imagine, because the Ari is so identified with Tzfat, and yet he barely lived there. He arrived in 1570, talk of making an immediate impact. He succeeded the Ramak. The Moshe Cordovero died almost immediately. The Ari introduced a new theory of Kabbalah into the world, building on what came before him, emphasizing God's, so to speak, self-limitation in allowing man free will in the world and underscoring as well man's role in redeeming the world. Surely a comforting, inspirational approach to Torah in a world where Jews were, by and large, suffering in exile. The Arizal gave exile a purpose beyond suffering. In his words, it was to gather the sparks that ultimately would rectify all of mankind. Ari wrote almost nothing. His thoughts were recorded and disseminated by his disciples, especially Reb Chaim Vital, 1543 to 1620, who's a native of Tzfat, wrote the definitive work about the Ari's thoughts and practices called Eitz Chaim. Within a short time, a very short time, the Ari's influence was felt all over in davening, Nusach Ari. Keep in mind, the Ari was an Ashkenazi, so he himself didn't daven Nusach Ari. He davened like Nusach Ashkenaz. But nonetheless, his followers implemented a Nusach based on his teachings. They added Kabbalah Shabbos, the Mizmorei Tehillim that we say, beginning with Chun Aranana, that would slowly, over the next few centuries, infiltrate the Jewish world. It wasn't universal, Luchun Aran, until the 18th century. Numerous other minhagim and hanhagos that supplement Jewish life until today, whether it's on Pesach or Sukkos, minhag Ari, it's one of the famous answers to any question. If you ask someone, why do you do this? And if you have no idea why you're doing it, all you have to say is, that's the meaning of the Ari. And no one is going to argue with you because nobody knows. But with the Ari and the Mechaber, Reb Moshe Cordovero, Reb Moshe Alshich, Reb Yaakov Berav, Reb Moshe Trani, the Mabit, and many, many others, Tzfat, which is such a small geographical area, was an unimaginably vibrant Makom Torah in the 16th century, and the expulsion from Spain played an indispensable role in creating this environment. It also had its effects on Italy. By the beginning of the 16th century, Jewish Italy was in decline. I noted already there was a reluctance to embrace the Jews of Spain. The decline was fostered by the ruthlessness of some church officials, most infamously Gerolamo Savonarola, who was a rabid Dominican priest who hated Jews, hated the Medici popes, including Alexander VI, just as much, who became infamous for his burnings, not only of people, but of books and sculptures, mirrors, cosmetics. That's where the phrase is from. It was the original bonfire of the vanities. He took everything that he felt made people vain, paintings and perfume, etc., and went from town to town burning everything, until Alexander VI, the Pope, burnt him in 1498. But the popes had to be careful not to offend the pious in their midst, and this had dire ramifications for the Jews. So already by the end of the 15th century, expulsions from various localities became common in Italy. In the late 15th, early 16th centuries, in Venice, though, a new approach was tried first in 1516, and that was the ghetto, a word of obscure origin, but likely related. Ghetto means foundry. The original ghetto was in an iron foundry in the Careggio neighborhood of Venice, a very small, cramped area. Jews were forced to live there. 700 Jews lived in the original ghetto in Venice. Because of that, and it's a small area, the buildings were very tall, some of them 8 stories. The shuls, until today, are in very narrow, very high buildings because space was limited. There are no freestanding shuls, for example, in Venice. They're all attached to other shuls, and literally, just it's almost completely vertical. Very little floor space. The name ghetto caught on, maybe because of its phonetic similarity to the word get, because what the ghetto symbolized was our divorce from the Christian world. So Jews lived in the ghetto in Venice, and then not only the name, but the approach caught on. Rather than expel Jews, they'd be forced to live together behind walls. Notwithstanding the ghetto, at the same time the Jews were living in the ghetto, Venice became the legendary capital of Hebrew publishing. In 1516, same year that the ghetto was created, a non-Jew named Daniel Bamberg, only non-Jews could publish, was given a church permit to publish Sfarim, and together with Jews, Rabbi Yisrael Eidelkin, Rabbi Eliyahu Bachur, and an apostate, Felix Pratensis, he invested in a printing press, and over the next few decades published more than 200 Sfarim, including the first so-called Mikros Gedolos, with the same Mepharshim we have today, and the first Talmud with the pagination that we have today. That is to say, Rashi on the inside of the page, Tosfos on the outside of the page, done in the early 1520s, and approved by Pope Leo X. Again, the popes varied in their approach to Jews. Some were more benign, some were more hostile. Leo X happened to be a benign pope. Bamberg's fonts became famous. For years, even other works would claim as an advertising pitch that their books were printed with Bamberg type. Something else happened, and Italy was the center of publishing, and all the Sfarim today reflected. He was a great Jew. He also lived a short life. Rabbi Yeshua Boaz Baruch, 1518 to 1553, the 35 years. So he wrote, the scholars know, he wrote the Shulta Gibarim on the Rif, but he's best known for what lines the pages of the text of the Talmud, the Torah Or. He gave the source for every pasuk quote in the Talmud, the Maseres HaShas, the parallel references, where this memor is found elsewhere in Shas, the Ein Mishpat, the source of the Halach and the Rambam and the Smag and the Tur, and the Ner Mitzvah was added a little later. By the way, he was 35 years old, Rav Shua Boaz Baruch, when he died. He wrote this in his late 20s and early 30s. he didn't have the Bar Ilan CD-ROM. The man had an encyclopedic knowledge of Shas to be, and Tanakh, to be able to find a pasuk, to look at a pasuk and say, there's the source. Or look at a Gemara, a minor, and say, this is mentioned three other places in Shas and recorded. Or know offhand where it's found in the Tur or the Rambam. It's a tremendous Talmud Chacham. Another great Jew got involved in publishing as well, the doctor too, Rav Avadya Sfarno, mentioned him briefly last week. He was instrumental in establishing the printing press in Bologna, wrote a famous commentary on the Torah. So with all the publishing going on in Italy, naturally there were big feuds as well, none more so than the famous dispute in the 1550s that also had lasting consequences. Just to summarize briefly, I gave a whole presentation on this in Italy a few times. It's a great Rav, the Maram of Padua, which is a city located about 15, 20 miles west of Venice, Rav Meir Katzenelnbogen, 1482 to 1565, Maram of Padua, chief rabbi of Padua and the Venice Republic. He wrote a parish on the Rambam, and he contracted with a non-Jew named Bragadini to publish his commentary with a new edition of the Rambam. Meanwhile, another non-Jew named Justiniani also wanted to publish the Rambam. He felt he would have more buyers if he published the Maram's commentary as well. So he asked the Maram for permission, and the Maram rebuffed him because he had already contracted with Bragadini. Justiniani published the Maram's commentary anyway in his Rambam. There are no copyright laws then. The Maram of Padua then appealed to his cousin, the Ramah, in Krakow to put a cherem on anyone who purchased Justiniani's Rambam. And the Ramah complied for four reasons that you find in the Shut of the Ramah. The offended Justiniani went to the church, and he contended that the Rambam, the Yad HaZakah, blasphemes Christianity. Only Bragadini's Rambam, apparently, not his, but his as well. Pope Julius III, in 1553, decided to split the difference and burn everything. Burn all sets of the Rambam that were extant, as well as banning publishing of any Jewish books. For good measure, the evil Cardinal Carafa burnt thousands of Svarim in the Campo di Fiori in Rome. It's now a food market, on Rosh Hashanah 1553. And this had a devastating effect on Talmud Torah in Italy, even though it wasn't like the book burnings of the 13th century, because now when a favorable pope or situation would arise, they could just start running off more copies. But this Rasha, Cardinal Carafa, when he became Pope Paul IV in 1555, he restricted all Jews in the Christian world to ghettos. He barred Jews from commerce, real Jew hater. He forced the Jews of Rome to wear yellow cone hats. The good news is that he, like most popes then, to some extent now too, took office while elderly. He was 79, and so he died 4 years later, in 1559. When he died, all these decrees were gradually revoked. Printing resumed, but now with censorship. That was the norm for the next four centuries, so Christians would not be offended by anything found in the Talmud or the Rambam. That's why you find manuscripts before Venice, before the 16th century, are usually complete, and from then on, they have these censored editions, big spaces, gaps in the Gemara, passages left out of the Rambam, etc. But the community suffered grievously. There was one consequence of this printing dispute. In 1554, rabbinical conference in Ferrara, it's also not far from Padua, the Maharam of Padua headed the conference, and there the Rabbonim passed an ordinance requiring that before every sefer is published in the Jewish world, there be a haskama, an attestation that both the sefer and the publisher are kosher. And since then until today, that is the norm for all Svarim. Every sefer carries an approbation from someone saying it's fit to read. Or sometimes it's just, I read the book, and that's it. If you actually read the Haskamos in Hebrew, sometimes they're not all praiseworthy. So something else happened during this Pope's tenure, a major international incident with far-reaching effects. So this same Pope, Pope Paul IV, in 1555 ordered the arrests of all conversos in Ancona, in Italy. It was a port city. Many of those arrested were Turkish conversos who were there in Ancona on business. This antagonized the leaders of Turkish Jewry, and especially two very celebrated conversos who had returned to the fold, two of the most exotic figures of the 16th century. One was a woman, Doña Gracia Mendez Nasi, 1510 to 1569. She was a Portuguese converso, raised the non-Jew, Beatriz de Luna. She married a converso in 1528, Francisco Mendez, who was wealthy, dealer in precious stones, a merchant, a banker. He had a bank based in Portugal, but he had a large branch in Antwerp, which helped. She left Portugal. He died after just a few years of their marriage. One daughter moved to England, then to Belgium. She was a society woman, an aristocrat, and then she moved to Venice. And in Venice, she was denounced to the Inquisition by her own sister, because the Christians wanted to seize her wealth. She was rescued by a Turkish diplomat. Then she moved to Turkey. In 1553, in Constantinople, she became an open Jew, spent a fortune on absorbing conversos into the Ottoman Empire, and another fortune building yeshivos and shuls in Constantinople, in Salonika, and elsewhere as well. She had a nephew, Don Yosef Nasi, 1524 to 1579. A nephew also became her son-in-law. He married her only daughter, Reina. So he traveled with his aunt. He became involved in the business too. In 1554, in Constantinople, he too ended the conversa charade, became an open Jew, had a bris, and adopted his new name, Yosef, Don Yosef Nasi. Because of the money, he became a very powerful and respected Jew, a friend, an advisor, and supporter of Suleiman the Magnificent, the Sultan. The Sultan appointed him the Duke of Naxos. Sounds impressive. It was a small island in the Mediterranean, so he became the Duke of that island, even though he never lived there, in 1566. He also was given the right to establish a colony in Caveria, which he did. And that, in fact, was the only time Jews had sovereignty, or something approaching sovereignty, from the time of the Churban until 1548. He ran it as his colony, built the yeshiva in Caveria too, sustained it, but after half a century, it more or less died out and was absorbed again into the Ottoman Empire. He got involved in the succession dispute after Suleiman died. Fortunately, wound up on the right side, supporting Selim, his son. In gratitude, Selim gave him the monopoly over all wine that was transported through the Bosphorus. He became even more wealthy. And now it gets interesting. When the King of France seized Nasi family property in France, Don Yosef Nasi confiscated one-third of the merchandise on French ships in Alexandria until the Sultan put a stop to it and he regained his property. Now, with the situation in Ancona, where these Turkish conversos had been imprisoned, Doña Gracia and Yosef Nasi went into action. They appealed to Suleiman the Magnificent on behalf of these Turkish Jews. Suleiman sent a nasty message to the Pope, threatening all the remaining Christians and Christian property in the Ottoman Empire if his Jews were not released. And in fact, the Pope Paul IV caved in, released the Jews, released their property. But in vengeance, on the 3rd of Iyar in 1556, Pope Paul IV burnt at the stake 26 Portuguese conversos who had returned to Jewish life. This sparked outrage in the Jewish world, and it's the rarity of the response that's noteworthy. Many Jews fled Ancona, relocating to another port city, Pesaro, 40 miles to the north, which was not a papal state. An emissary was sent to the Sultan, to Turkey, asking for a boycott of the port in Ancona. Under pressure from Doña Gracia, the Sultan agreed to boycott Ancona in August of 1556, And so Yosef Nassif's immense fleet boycotted the port. The Jews of Salonika, most Turkish Jews, boycotted as well within a month. Ancona was brought to its knees. The government and the papal state appealed to the Pope to do something. They were going broke because Ancona, the whole commerce was based on there being a port, and now it was finished. For the very first time in our history, international Jewry united to combat persecution using the only weapons that we had, money and influence. So how did it turn out? It's a powerful statement. Didn't turn out as well as we hoped. The boycott foundered because the Jews were divided. It's nice to boycott the port in Ancona, but who ran the port in Ancona? Jews. And they said, they're the ones who are being ruined. They're innocent of wrongdoing, but they're the primary victims. When I spoke about this a number of times overseas, I compared it to a recent situation as well. In the 90s and early 00s, maybe till today as well, many Jews don't go to France. Certainly before Sarkozy became the president, just to protest their anti-Israel, anti-Jewishness. But who are the primary victims of that? The French Jews. Because nobody goes to their restaurants, nobody shops in their stores, no one visits them. So they become indirect victims, even though there's no simple answer. So in fact, they were innocent of wrongdoing. They didn't leave Ancona. They're the primary victims of the boycott, and now the Pope might kill them because of what's happening. Their Rav, the Rav of Ancona, Moshe Basula, appealed to the Turkish Rabbonim for assistance and support. Rabbi Yeshua Sansino died in 1569, was the Rav of the Majorcan community of exiles in Constantinople. He opposed the ban, opposed the boycott on the grounds that it was harming the remaining Jews in Ancona and the rest of Italy. He wrote that other Rabbonim agreed with him, but they were afraid to go public. I've heard that before too. Rabbi Yeshua now bitterly opposed Don Yosef Nasi, put tremendous pressure on him to retract his psak. He refused. Rabbi Yosef Karo from Tzat supported the boycott. The Mabit also supported the boycott, but said in his Truvos, in Chelek Aleph, Siman Reish Lamed Zayin of the Mabit, you can't force merchants to participate. For as long as it lasted, though, it was a first. But the whole situation came to an abrupt end when Paul IV died in 1559. It was such a jam-packed century that we haven't even touched upon the real Torah centers yet, and those who are in Europe, especially Poland. Polish Jewry, residents of Poland for several centuries already, came into their own in the 16th century and became the world Torah center. Reb Moshe Isserles, another Jew of the short life, the Ramah, 1530 to 1572, 42 years. He had a short and very busy life. He was a Talmud Muvhak of the great of Shalom Shachna of Lublin, a major Rosh Yeshiva in the 16th century, also became his son-in-law, and then became the Rav in Krakow. In 1551-52, within an 11-month period, when the Ramah's mother and wife and grandmother all died, he built a shul in their memory. Known until today, it still stands as the Ramah shul right near his grave. The Ramah, besides being one of the great poskim in Europe of the century, wrote the Mapa on the Shulchan Aruch, the Darkei Moshe on the Beis Yosef, and he was the Rebbe of many of those who would write other commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, like the Levush, Mordechai Yaffa, we'll get back to him in a few moments, Rabbi Yeshua Falt HaKohen, the Sma, Mir Sinayim, and Rav David Gans, who became famous as an astronomer and mathematician in Prague, where he was a colleague of sorts with Tycho Brahe and Johann Kepler in the late 16th century. Also in Poland, you had the Marshal of Shlomo Luria, Rosh Yeshiva in Brisk, and then Lublin. He halted a method of Talmudic study that had been introduced earlier in the 15th and early 16th centuries by Rabbi Yaakov Polak, known as Pilpul, that it was a method of learning that featured very arcane and often flimsy connections between different areas of the Talmud that more demonstrated the practitioner's versatility in Shas but did not always teach the simple pshat. Pilpul, for the most part, gave the Talmud a bad name, and generations warred against it successfully, and is practically unknown today. But the first combatant against Pilpul was the Marshal Rav Shlomo Luria. Another giant was the Marshal Rav Shmuel Edels, 1555 to 1632. He was supported by his mother-in-law, the fantasy of many young yeshiva bachur. But what they don't do is what he did. He took her name as his last name, Edels, in honor of her, Marshal. He founded a yeshiva in Posen and then in Ostro, but he was mainly known for his perush on the Gemara and both the halachic part and the agadic part that is indispensable in ascertaining the pshat in the Gemara. Meanwhile, in France and Germany, a very small Jewish community, by the 16th century, they're down to just four communities. In France and Alsace, Jews were saved from being victims during the Peasants' War of 1525 by another first, the intervention of Rabbi Yosef Yozelman of Rosheim, who was probably the first official Shtadlon. He secured a letter of protection from the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V, who strangely enough was the grandson of Ferdinand and Isabella, and the one who turned over Shlomo Molcho to the Inquisition. Nonetheless, now he defended Jews. He permitted them to build shuls in France, to lend money. He banned expulsions. He banned the wearing of special badges. Later, from his successor, King Ferdinand, Rabbi Yosef Yozelman also gained protection for the Jews of Germany and Bohemia and Moravia. Now, this was critical because of another transformative event in world history that took place in the 16th century that also would have long-lasting effects on Jewish life. In 1517, Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses to the church door in Wittenberg, complaining about the endemic corruption in the Catholic Church, sale of indulgences, the extravagances of the Pope. For example, thesis number 86, why does the Pope, Luther asked, whose wealth today is greater than the wealth of the richest Crassus, build the Basilica of St. Peter with the money of poor believers rather than with his own money? It's a good question. I think it was a rhetorical question. He didn't get an answer. But with Luther's challenge, the Protestant Reformation erupted throughout Europe and the world. Luther assumed, as did earlier Christians, as did Mohammed for that matter, that Jews would embrace his new movement. He held that the Jews' rejection of Catholicism was natural and warranted, that it was a rejection of the idolatry of the Pope. But now that he was reforming Christianity, taking away the rough idolatrous edges, he assumed the Jews would sign on too. Well, when the Jews refused to follow Luther also, he became enraged and openly and wrote, called for, and this you see, unfortunately, repeated throughout history, these statements of Luther, the burning of their synagogues and schools, the confiscation of all their holy books and their wealth, the banning of Jews from the highways in the country, saying the Jews are our misfortune. Words that the Nazis would quote verbatim from Luther, the Jews are umglick, our misfortune. Luther had a transformation. He went from writing in 1523 an essay called That Jesus Was Born a Jew, saying why he had to be born a Jew and what the Jews bring to the world, and denouncing blood libels in that very essay, to another essay exactly 20 years later, 1543, called On the Jews and Their Lies. Well, I guess you get right to the point in the title. Like Muhammad, he felt keenly the sting of rejection. He had a long-lasting effect. In 1946, Julius Streicher would say at Nuremberg that if he, Streicher, and the Nazis are on trial, Martin Luther should stand in the dock with him and them, because Nazi Jew hatred follows a straight line from Luther. And indeed, it is so. And as strange as it sounds, the Lutheran Church had to renounce Luther's Jew hatred in the 1990s, just 10, 15 years ago. So obvious its pernicious effects on any moral aspirations. The Peasants' War, I mentioned a few moments ago, was instigated at Luther's behest as he openly combated Catholicism, and the Catholics, you talk of rabid Jew hatred, blamed the Jews for Luther's heresy. Because Luther went off the derech because the Jews had not accepted Christianity. But now Jews would have a new Christian foe, Protestantism, that only in its American manifestation, centuries away, would extend a gracious hand to the people of Israel. Finally, you talk of great dominant figures. We've spoken so much about the 16th century and not even mentioned one of the geniuses of then and of all time, Rabbi Yehuda Leiva, the Maharal of Prague, 1526 to 1609, born in Posen, actually spent relatively little of his life in Prague. He was the Rav in Nikolsburg, then chief rabbi of all of Moravia before coming to Prague in 1573. He was driven out of Prague by a community that did not appreciate his drushos. It happens. Especially, he denounced what he held to be the two main vices of Prague Jewry. Adultery, that was rampant, and Lashon Hara, that was rampant as well. They just want him to preach Judaism, but not get involved, you know, in their business. So what he did at a certain time, he went to Posen, at a certain time he switched places with the Levush, rabbinic fantasy. Two rabbanim were not successful in their communities. Let's switch. Maybe it'll be better off. Now, Levush, Rav Mordechai Yaffa, 1535 to 1612, he was originally from Prague, a native of Prague. The Levush, to digress for a moment, proves that timing is everything in life. When he heard about the Beis Yosef, he decided to write the condensation of the Beis Yosef, only to learn that Rabbi Yosef Karo was already doing that to the Shulchan Aruch. So he had to abandon his project. When the Shulchan Aruch came out, it was published, he decided to write an accompanying volume to conform it to Ashkenazic practice, only to learn that his teacher, the Rama, had already done that as well. So he would write and stop, write and stop. Finally, he wrote his own commentary, Levush, in multi-volumes, not as lengthy as the Beis Yosef, not as terse as the Shulchan Aruch. He also wrote the Levush HaOrah on Rashi, another super commentary, but he also challenged one of the Maharal's major works, the Gur Aryeh, another commentary on Rashi. The Maharal was an incredible author, Gemara, philosophy, Hashkafa, that's had a revival really in the last century through Rav Kook, through Rav Dessler, and others. He had a deep, very intense respect for every word of Chazal, even attacking in print in one of the Svarim, the Be'er HaGolah, a sefer called the Ma'or Inayim of Rav Azaria de Rossi, Azaria ben Adomim, an Italian Rav, bit of a modernist, 1511-1578, whose criticisms of certain statements of Chazal would make him, Rav Azaria de Rossi, a hero to Maskilim 2.5 centuries later. In his own lifetime, his books were widely banned, even in Italy. So Maharal wrote a book. Part of the book is a condemnation and refutation of the Rav Azaria de Rossi's Ma'or Einayim. Maharal returned to Prague 1598. From Posen, that didn't work out either. He went back to Prague, the Levush went back to Posen, and there the Maharal served the last years of his life, last 10, 11 years of his life, as the Rav again in Prague, becoming an influential figure, even in government circles. I just append to this, the Goylem stories of the Prague are, of course, fictional. They're based on a historical novel that was written in the late 19th century, have no basis in reality, and were the unfortunate result of the Jewish people's unfamiliarity with the genre of fiction, or really with literature generally. So once it was published, people assumed it was meant to be historically accurate. One other point bears mention. The Jewish population in the 16th century was small. Prague Jews in the Maharal's time, the major city, numbered in the very low thousands. German Jews had been reduced to 4 communities. The largest community in Poland held less than 200,000 Jews. and the world Jewish population was less than 1 million people. But what a century, and what great figures inhabited this century. The expulsion from Spain had dispatched Jews across the world, reviving the land of Israel, producing giants like Rabbi Yosef Karin, the Shulchan Aruch, the Radvaz, the Arizal, the rise of Kabbalah, the Maral, the Ramah, the explosion of Jewish printing, and that controversy, the Smicha controversy, the rise of Luther, the first false messiahs, the first Jewish diplomacy, so to speak, an international Jewish boycott that caused Jew haters to retreat even temporarily. In a century in which the persecution was relatively benign, I say that meaning it, relatively benign, especially compared to the 15th century, Torah flourished. There were still sporadic blood libels and expulsions and massacres, but not as extensive as before. But the ghetto did receive its name. In the 17th century, we will again encounter vicious and deadly Jew hatred. We'll see Jewish eyes again tear in Europe, and those same eyes turn west to America. I thank you all very much.